A sense of fulfillment is available to the man in the street, indeed, in the face of dying and suffering. To demonstrate this, let me again take up the letter mentioned in the preface to the first English edition, 1975, received from a prisoner at the Baltimore County Prison. This was a man who was financially ruined in jail, and yet at complete peace with himself and the world after he had found a meaning in even such a miserable life. He concluded the letter by exclaiming, "How wonderful life is! I embrace today, anxiously await tomorrow." Pre-reflective ontological self-understanding really consists of two aspects: a pre-logical understanding of being and a pre-moral understanding of meaning. In some cases, however, both aspects are repressed. Neither is compatible with indoctrination in a reductionist philosophy of life, which results in nihilism, to which the reaction is cynicism. I once had to take over the treatment of an outstanding psychoanalyst who was caught in a severe depression resulting from nihilism. It was hard to help him find his way to the existential ground on which the direction and vision of values again were available to him. Available to him because he was himself the direction and vision. There is a point at which being and meaning merge. This, after all, is the reason why the pre-moral understanding of meaning is rooted in the pre-logical understanding of being, and both are blended into pre-reflective ontological self-understanding. Even in die-hard positivists, the wisdom of the heart may supersede the knowledge of the brain and allow for recognizing the unconditional meaningfulness of life through the potential meaning of suffering. From this I would not even exempt the nihilists. It is strange, a graduate psychology student of the University of California at Berkeley writes in a letter to me, the nihilists first laugh at your concept of meaning through suffering, and ultimately their tears dissolve them. It is obvious that Nicholas Mosley was right when he wrote that there is a subject nowadays which is taboo in the way that sexuality was once taboo, which is to talk about life as if it had any meaning. It therefore is understandable that logotherapy is facing some resistance. It is no longer confronted and concerned with instinctual and sexual frustrations and repressions, but with the frustration and consequent repression of the will to meaning. Not eros, but logos is the victim of repression. Once the will to meaning is repressed, however, the existence of meaning is no longer perceived. Logotherapy aims to unlock the will to meaning and to assist the patient in seeing a meaning in his life. In so doing, however, it leans on the phenomenological analysis of pre-reflective ontological self-understanding. It borrows from what the patient knows by the wisdom of his heart and in the depth of his unconscious. Through logotherapy, this knowledge is brought to the surface of consciousness. And if it has been my contention that phenomenology means translating the wisdom of the heart into scientific terms, I now may add another definition. Logotherapy means retranslating this wisdom of the heart into plain words, into the language of the man in the street, so that he may benefit from it. And it is possible to convey it to him. Let me just restate what happened when I spoke to the prisoners of San Quentin in 1966 at the request of the prison's director. After I had addressed these prisoners, who were the toughest criminals in California, one stood up and said, "Dr. Frankel, would you be kind enough to say a few words through the mic to Aaron Mitchell, who is expecting to die in the gas chamber in a couple of days? The people on death row are not allowed to come down to the chapel, but perhaps you will say a few words particularly to him." An embarrassing position, but I had to accept this challenge and say a few words. I improvisingly said, "Mr. Mitchell, believe me, I understand your situation. I myself had to live for some time in the shadow of a gas chamber. But also believe me that even then I did not give up my conviction of the unconditional meaningfulness of life, because either life has meaning, and then it retains this meaning even if the life is short-lived, or life has no meaning, and then adding ever more years just perpetuates this meaninglessness. And believe me, even a life that has been meaningless all along, that is, a life that has been wasted, may, even in the last moment, still be bestowed with meaning by the very way in which we tackle this situation." And then I told him the story of Leo Tolstoy's The Death of Ivan Ilyich, the tale of a man who is about 60 years of age and suddenly learns that he is to die in a couple of days. By the insight he gains from this knowledge and from the realization that he has wasted his life, that his life has been virtually meaningless, he grows beyond himself and finally becomes capable, retroactively, of flooding his life with infinite meaning. To all appearances, this message got across. If I had doubted it, I would have been convinced later when I came across an article in the May 10th San Francisco Chronicle about an unusual press conference that Aaron Mitchell began by handing out this brief statement he had typed himself. I have made my appeal to God and to the governor. This is my last appeal to man. Forgive me, for I knew not. As he met newspaper reporters at the prison under the careful eyes of guards, Mitchell said, I don't really expect clemency from the governor, and I sympathize with him. He will be under criticism either way, but much lighter criticism if he fails to act for me. The condemned man, seemingly much calmer than his interviewers, also said he feared his own execution may start a long new line to the gas chamber. Mitchell acknowledged the drizzle of rain outside. It always seems to rain when things are bad, and the rain is God in anger. The first friends he ever had in his life, he said, were two death row guards who appeared at his sentence-determining penalty trial after he had been waiting in the prison. It was the first time in my entire life someone was willing to stand up and say, I know this man. I'll speak in his behalf, Mitchell told reporters. What I'd like to feel these last days I have of life is that if you're home or in the office, at work or play when you read this, stand up and say to yourself, I feel as if I know this man. He could have been my friend, because I feel the need of friends in my dying hour, he said. We must not overlook and forget that even self-administered logotherapy may be helpful and may even change the life of professionals. In this context, I would like to quote from two letters I recently received. All my life I have been in engineering management. I am presently in a salary bracket which puts me in the upper 2% of salaries earned in the United States. Yet in spite of my relatively high salary and the responsible positions I have had, I felt an emptiness in my life. It has only been in the last few years that my life started to have meaning. Logotherapy clearly put my life in perspective and allowed me to gain an understanding which I had never had before. I am now in the process of changing my profession from engineering management to clinical psychology. I will not make as much money or be in as responsible a position as I am now in, but I know that the direction I have taken will have more meaning for me regardless of money or position. Here the frustrated will to meaning had been compensated by the will to power, position, plus one might call a will to money. The man had belonged with those who have the means, the financial means, but no meaning. However, once his will to meaning had been reawakened and meaning began to dawn on him, any overconcern with money, which is the mere means to an end rather than the end itself, subsided. And here is the second letter. As a therapist, I was primarily Freudian by training. All that Freudian philosophy had promised, I had received in abundance. A very expensive home with pool, two late model cars, three healthy, bright children, loving wife and companion, and an occupation that brought pride and acceptance from the community. But still, something was missing. I felt the existential vacuum. I had accepted the tranquil state as being the end result of therapy. Now that I have reestablished a new quest in my life, the existential vacuum is dissipating. I face surgery of the esophagus and stomach within the next 2 months. Instead of depression, I find myself facing this with the feeling that the experience will make me a better person. The forced loss of 35 pounds will certainly be part of this. Here, as we see, the rediscovery of meaning even included attitudinal values. That meaning can be found not only in spite of, but also because of, unavoidable suffering, such as an incurable disease, say, an inoperable cancer, is a possibility more easily understood by the man in the street than by the expert in the field. Beverly Hills realtor Fred Harris had inoperable cancer of both lungs. According to a report published in Time magazine for August 14, 1972, Harris formed a self-help program through which cancer victims who have more or less adjusted to their illness counsel others who have not. Judd Marmer rightly commented that the project can also be therapeutic for the person who is doing the helping. It gives him a purpose in life at a point where the curtain seems to be drawing down. Other authors, however, are not prepared to take such a motivation at its face value. In Life-Threatening Behavior, the official journal of the American Association of Suicidology, Paul H. Blockley of the University of Oregon Medical School once suggested that the suicidal person who wants to destroy his whole body may find an alternative in sacrificing just a part of it, by donating either blood or an organ to a person who needs it to live. One would assume that Blockley advocates an approach similar to logotherapy, which teaches that suicide may be caused by a feeling of meaninglessness, and that its prevention accordingly presupposes that the patient discover a meaning to life. However, this is not so. Blockley apparently does not see man as a being in search of meaning. He therefore cannot understand either that man is willing to sacrifice everything if there is meaning in such a sacrifice, or the corollary of this proposition, that man does not care for a life without meaning. Once we eliminate from our vision of man the human dimension in which such human phenomena as the will to meaning are located, we must construct, not to say invent, drives and instincts to explain human behavior, without recognizing that by the very nature of such an explanation, man's behavior actually is dehumanized. Small wonder that Blockley is compelled to hypothesize a death wish and believes that a patient who is prone to suicide is a plaything of the death wish. To be sure, this wish might be purged if the donor gives an organ that is not essential to his own life. People who donate a kidney, Blockley notes, often experience a sustained feeling of satisfaction. Satisfaction of the death wish, that is. In actual fact, I would say, these people have discovered a meaning to life and a reason for survival. However, a psychology that a priori shuts out meaning and reason cannot recognize the self-transcendent quality of the human reality, and instead must resort to drives and instincts. Whenever the pulling force exerted by meanings and reasons is obscured, the pushing force of drives and instincts is hypothesized. Before, I spoke of meaningful suffering in terms of sacrifice, which brings to mind a story that, because of its brevity, I like to tell my students in order to illustrate how suffering may be bestowed with meaning. It is the story of a physician who suffered from severe depression after his wife died. I embarked on a short Socratic dialogue by asking him what would have happened if he had died first. "How much she would have suffered," he answered. What was now left to me was simply to respond, "Your wife has been spared this suffering, and after all, it is you who are sparing her this suffering, to be sure at the price that now you have to survive and mourn her." At the same moment, he could see a meaning in his suffering, the meaning of a sacrifice. There was still suffering, but no longer despair, because despair is suffering without meaning. When I tell this brief story, I am often blamed for having imposed meanings and values on the patient. As it happens, however, it can be shown that what I actually did was intuitively elicit from the patient what the man in the street knows by virtue of the wisdom of the heart. Edwin S. Schneidman provided clear-cut empirical data relevant to the issue at hand. He distributed to the students at Harvard a class questionnaire that included the question, "If and when you are married, would you prefer to outlive your spouse, or would you prefer your spouse to outlive you?" The typical male response was, in fact, to choose to die after the wife. As an interlude, let us imagine what help could have been offered to the physician whose wife had died if a rigidly orthodox behavior therapist had had to tackle the situation. Let us see what behavior modifiers suggest when death or some other irrevocable happening deprives one of something cherished. A schedule should be devised by which the individual's efforts are systematically rewarded, sometimes starting with such minor accomplishments as making a telephone call, mowing the lawn, or washing dishes. These behaviors are praised and in other ways rewarded by the therapist, and after a time come to give the patient a sense of satisfaction quite directly. let us hope. As to the feeling of meaningfulness per se, it is an existential despair and a spiritual distress rather than an emotional disease or a mental illness. This, however, in no way implies that we must discard and abolish the medical model. What we must do is simply recognize its limits. Within these limits, mental illness is no myth at all, but we have to distinguish among the various levels at which its etiological point of departure may be located. Mental illness may be psychogenic, neurosis, or somatogenic, psychosis, in nature and origin. But noagenic and psychiatrogenic pseudo-neuroses also exist. And last but not least, the existential vacuum exists. It is something sociogenic and not at all a neurosis. It is important that this be conveyed to the non-patients suffering from it. They should know that despair over the apparent meaninglessness of life constitutes a human achievement rather than a neurosis. After all, no animal cares whether or not its existence has a meaning. It is the prerogative of man to quest for a meaning to his life, and also to question whether such meaning exists. This quest is a manifestation of intellectual sincerity and honesty. In particular, it is the challenge of youth to question the meaning of life. However, the courage to question should be matched by patience. People should be patient enough to wait until, sooner or later, meaning dawns on them. This is what they should do rather than taking their lives or taking refuge in drugs. All this should be conveyed to man by way of first aid in cases of existential vacuum. To demonstrate how important such first aid might be, I would like to quote Albert Einstein. "The man who regards his life as meaningless is not merely unhappy, but hardly fit for life." Indeed, survival is dependent on direction. However, survival cannot be the supreme value. Unless life points to something beyond itself, survival is pointless and meaninglessness. It is not even possible. This is the very lesson I learned in 3 years spent in Auschwitz and Dachau. And in the meantime, it has been confirmed by psychiatrists in prisoner of war camps. Only those who were oriented toward the future, toward a goal in the future, toward a meaning to fulfill in the future, were likely to survive. And I think that this is not only true of the survival of individuals, but also holds for the survival of mankind. For there is hope for mankind's survival only as long as people will arrive at the awareness of common denominators in axiological terms, that is to say, common denominators in what they feel makes their lives worth living. It is thus obvious that the subject boils down to an axiological issue. Will there be values and meanings that can be shared by people and peoples? Values and meanings they might have in common? The only thing I know for sure is that if common values and meanings are to be found, another step now must be taken, thousands of years after mankind developed monotheism, the belief in the one God. Monotheism is not enough. It will not do. What we need is not only the belief in the one God, but also the awareness of the one mankind, the awareness of the unity of humanity. I would call it monanthropism. There is survival value in the will to meaning, as we have seen. But as to mankind, there is hope for survival only if mankind is united by a common will to a common meaning. In other words, by an awareness of common tasks. In the paper quoted previously, Carolyn Wood Sharif reported the results of experiments with children in whom group aggressions had been built up. However, once they were united by the common task of dragging a carriage out of the mud, the kids forgot to live out their group aggressions. Let us learn the lesson. Yet we psychiatrists should refrain from dabbling in fields other than our own. I would say that each issue deserves to be taken up by a specialist. So why not leave something, say, to the sociologists? We psychiatrists simply don't have the answer for each and every question. Least of all, do we have a prescription to hand out when it comes to the question of how to cure all the ills that afflict our society. Let us start humanizing psychiatry rather than divinizing it. And to begin with, let us stop ascribing divine attributes to psychiatrists. We psychiatrists are neither omniscient nor omnipotent. We are only omnipresent, mingling at all symposia and joining in all discussions. As to logotherapy, it is not a panacea. It therefore is open to cooperation with other approaches to psychotherapy. It is open to its own evolution, and it is open to religion. This is indispensable. It is true, logotherapy deals with the logos. It deals with meaning. Specifically, I see the meaning of logotherapy in helping others to see meaning in life. But one cannot give meaning to the life of others. And if this is true of meaning per se, how much more does it hold for ultimate meaning? The more comprehensive the meaning, the less comprehensible it is. Infinite meaning is necessarily beyond the comprehension of a finite being. Here is the point at which science gives up and wisdom takes over. Wisdom is knowledge plus knowledge and the knowledge of its own limits. Chapter 9. Man's Search for Ultimate Meaning. Oscar Pfister Award Lecture, 1985, at the annual meeting of the American Psychiatric Association in Dallas, Texas. Ladies and gentlemen, if a speaker comes from Vienna, you certainly expect him to speak with a heavy Viennese accent, as I do. And if he is a psychiatrist at that, you also expect him to start his lecture with a reference to Sigmund Freud. Why not? All of us have learned from him to see in man a being basically concerned with seeking pleasure. It was Freud, after all, who introduced the concept of the pleasure principle, and the coexistence of the reality principle does in no way contradict his hypothesis of seeking pleasure as man's primary motivation. For, as he repeatedly stated, the reality principle is a mere extension of the pleasure principle, still serving the latter's purpose, which remains pleasure and nothing but pleasure. But we must not overlook and forget that the pleasure principle itself is, also according to Freud, no more than the servant of a more comprehensive principle, namely of the homeostasis principle, Canon 1932, whose goal is tension reduction for the sake of maintaining or restoring the inner equilibrium. However, what is missing in the frame of such an image of man is that fundamental characteristic of the human reality which I have come to term its self-transcendent quality. I thereby want to denote the intrinsic fact that being human always relates and points to something other than itself, better to say, something or someone. That is to say, rather than being concerned with any inner condition, be it pleasure or homeostasis, man is oriented toward the world out there. And within this world, he is interested in meanings to fulfill, and in other human beings. By virtue of what I would call the pre-reflective ontological self-understanding, he knows that he is actualizing himself precisely to the extent to which he is forgetting himself. And he is forgetting himself by giving himself, be it through serving a cause higher than himself, or loving a person other than himself. Truly, self-transcendence is the essence of human existence. It would seem that also the second of the two classic schools of Viennese psychotherapy, Adlerian psychology, does not pay sufficient tribute to self-transcendence. It mainly considers man a being who is out to overcome a certain inner condition, namely, the feeling of inferiority which he tries to get rid of by developing the striving for superiority, a concept that is by and large congruent with the Nietzschean will to power. As long as a motivation theory pivots on the will to pleasure, as we could rename the Freudian pleasure principle, or on the Adlerian striving for superiority, it proves to be a typical representative of so-called depth psychology. But what about a height psychology, Frankl, 1938, which takes into account the so-called higher aspirations of the human psyche, not only man's seeking pleasure and power, but also his search for meaning? It was Oscar Pfister, 1904, who recommended to move in such a direction when he as early as in 1904 pointed out that, more important, as seen in comparison with depth psychology, is the recognition of that spiritual height of our nature which is as powerful as its instinctual depth. It is true, rather than being a substitute for depth psychology, height psychology is only a supplement, to be sure a necessary one. But it does focus on the specifically human phenomena, among them man's desire to find and fulfill a meaning in his life, or for that matter in the individual life situations confronting him. I have circumscribed this most human of all human needs by the motivation theoretical term will to meaning. Frankl, 1949. Today, man's will to meaning is frustrated on a worldwide scale. Ever more people are haunted by a feeling of meaninglessness, which is often accompanied by a feeling of emptiness, or as I am used to calling it, an existential vacuum. Frankl, 1955. It mainly manifests itself in boredom and apathy. While boredom is indicative of a loss of interest in the world, apathy betrays a lack of the initiative to do something in the world, to change something in the world. So much for the phenomenology of the existential vacuum, and what about its epidemiology? Let me restrict myself to randomly picking up a passage that you may find in a book authored by Irvin D. Yalom, 1980. Of 40 consecutive patients applying for therapy at a psychiatric outpatient clinic, 30% had some major problem involving meaning as adjudged from self-ratings, therapists, or independent judges. As to myself, I neither think that each and every case of neurosis, let alone of psychosis, is to be traced back to a feeling of meaninglessness, nor do I think that a feeling of meaninglessness necessarily results in mental illness. In other words, neither is each and every case of neurosis noogenic, Frankl, 1959, i.e., deriving from an existential vacuum, nor is, conversely, the existential vacuum in each and every case pathogenic. Even less is it anything pathological. I rather regard it as a prerogative and privilege of man not only to quest for a meaning to his life, but also to question whether such a meaning exists at all. No other animal asks such a question. Not even one of Conrad Lorenz's clever gray geese does so, but man does. In a way, the existential vacuum may well be considered a sociogenic neurosis. No doubt our industrialized society is out to satisfy all human needs, and its companion, consumer society, is even out to create ever new needs to satisfy. But the most human need, the need to find and fulfill a meaning in our lives, is frustrated by this society. In the wake of industrialization, urbanization tends to uproot man from traditions and to alienate him from those values which are transmitted by the traditions. Understandably, it is in particular the young generation who is most affected by the resulting feeling of meaninglessness, as could be evidenced by empirical research. More specifically, such phenomena as addiction, aggression, and depression are, in the final analysis, due to a sense of futility. Again, to restrict myself to one quotation, of the drug addicts studied by Stanley Krippner, things seemed meaningless to not less than 100%. But after all these glimpses into the pathology of the zeitgeist, it is now time to ask ourselves, what is meant by meaning? Well, this word is used here in a sense that is absolutely down to earth, inasmuch as it refers to that which a concrete situation means to a concrete person. And as to the cognition of meaning, I would say it is to be located midway between a gestalt perception, say along the lines of Max Wertheimer's theory, and an aha experience along the lines of Karl Bühler's concept. Kurt Lewin, as well as Max Wertheimer, 1961, spoke of demand characteristics and demand qualities, respectively, as they are inherent in a given situation. In fact, each life situation confronting us places a demand on us, presents a question to us, a question to which we have to answer by doing something about the given situation. Thus, the perception of meaning differs from the classical concept of gestalt perception, insofar as the latter boils down to suddenly becoming aware of a figure on a ground, whereas the perception of meaning, as I see it, could be defined as suddenly becoming aware of a possibility against the background of reality. It goes without saying that we psychiatrists cannot tell a patient what a situation should mean to him. Even less is it possible to tell him wherein he should see the meaning of his life as a whole. But we may well show him that life never ceases to offer us a meaning up to its last moment, up to our last breath. We are indebted to no less than 20 researchers for, on strictly empirical grounds, having convinced us that people are capable of finding meaning in their lives irrespective of gender, age, IQ, educational background, character structure, environment, and most remarkably, also irrespective of whether or not they are religious, and if so, irrespective of the denomination to which they may belong. I thereby refer to the work of Brown, Casciani, Crumbaugh, Dansert, Durlach, Krotochville, Levinson, Lucas, Lunsford, Mason, Meyer, Murphy, Planova, Popielski, Richmond, Roberts, Rook, Sally, Smith, Yarnell, and Young. C.F. Frankel, 1985a. From this it follows that there must be a meaning to life under any conditions, even the worst conceivable ones. But how shall we explain this finding which so much contradicts the ubiquitous feeling of meaninglessness? Well, if we investigate how the man in the street goes about finding meaning, it turns out that there are three avenues that lead up to meaning fulfillment. First, doing a deed or creating a work. Second, experiencing something or encountering someone. In other words, meaning can be found not only in work, but also in love. Most important, however, is the third avenue. Facing a fate we cannot change, we are called upon to make the best of it by rising above ourselves and growing beyond ourselves. In a word, by changing ourselves. And this equally holds for the three components of the tragic triad, pain, guilt, and death, inasmuch as we may turn suffering into a human achievement and accomplishment, derive from guilt the opportunity to change for the better, and see in life's transitoriness an incentive to take responsible action. Frankel, 1984a. As to suffering, let me quote from the book of a German bishop, Moser, 1978, the following incident. A few years after World War II, a doctor examined a Jewish woman who wore a bracelet made of baby teeth mounted in gold. "A beautiful bracelet," the doctor remarked. "Yes," the woman answered. "This tooth here belonged to Miriam, this one to Esther, and this one to Samuel." She mentioned the names of her daughters and sons according to age. "Nine children," she added, "and all of them were taken to the gas chambers." Shocked, the doctor asked, "How can you live with such a bracelet?" Quietly, the Jewish woman replied, "I am now in charge of an orphanage in Israel." As you see, meaning may be squeezed out even from suffering, and that is the very reason why life remains potentially meaningful in spite of everything. But is this to say that suffering is indispensable for finding a meaning to life? In no way. I only insist that meaning is available in spite of, nay, even through suffering, provided, to be sure, that we have to deal with unavoidable suffering. If it were avoidable, the meaningful thing to do would be to remove its cause, be it psychological, biological, or sociological. Unnecessary suffering would be masochistic rather than heroic. When setting out to discuss the meaning of meaning, I referred to meaning as something down to earth. However, it cannot be denied that there is also some sort of meaning that is up to heaven, as it were. Some sort of ultimate meaning, that is. A meaning of the whole, of the universe, or at least a meaning of one's life as a whole. At any rate, a long-range meaning. And I do not think that it is worthy of a psychiatrist, or for that matter of any scientist, to deny on a priori grounds that such a long-range meaning does exist. To invoke an analogy, consider a movie. It consists of thousands upon thousands of individual pictures, and each of them makes sense and carries a meaning, yet the meaning of the whole film cannot be seen before its last sequence is shown. On the other hand, we cannot understand the whole film without having first understood each of its components, each of the individual pictures. Isn't it the same with life? Doesn't the final meaning of life, too, reveal itself, if ever at all, only at its end, on the verge of death? And doesn't the final meaning, too, depend on whether or not the potential meaning of each single situation has been actualized to the best of the respective individual's knowledge and belief? But once that we start dealing with an overall meaning, we soon meet a law that I would like to formulate as follows. The more comprehensive the meaning, the less comprehensible it is. And if it comes to ultimate meaning, also it necessarily is beyond comprehension. Consider a poor dog whom they are vivisecting in a laboratory, William James, 1897, said, when addressing the Harvard Young Men's Christian Association. He cannot see a single redeeming ray in the whole business, yet all these diabolic-seeming events are often controlled by human intentions with which, if his poor benighted mind could only be made to catch a glimpse of them, all that is heroic in him would religiously acquiesce. Lying on his back on the board there, he may be performing a function incalculably higher than any that prosperous canine life admits of. And yet, of the whole performance, this function is the one portion that must remain absolutely beyond his ken. Now turn from this to the life of man. Although we only see our world, and the dogs within it, yet encompassing both these worlds, a still wider world may be there, as unseen by us as our world is by him. What William James here did is, I would say, some sort of extrapolation. Well, I pride myself of having done something parallel, without knowing of James's priority, when I once stepped into a room of my hospital department where a doctor on my staff was conducting a psychodrama. The mother of a boy who had died at the age of 11 years had been admitted after a suicide attempt. Now she was telling her story. At the death of her boy, she was left alone with another older son who was severely handicapped. The poor boy had to be moved around in a wheelchair. His mother rebelled against her fate, but when she tried to commit suicide together with him, it was the son who prevented her from doing so. He liked living. For him, life had remained meaningful despite the handicap. Why was it not so for his mother? How could her life still have a meaning? And how could we help her to become aware of it? Improvising, I participated in the discussion, and addressing myself to the whole group, I asked the patients whether an ape which was being used to develop poliomyelitis serum, and for this reason punctured again and again, would ever be able to grasp the meaning of its suffering. Unanimously, the group replied that of course it would not. With its limited intelligence, it could not enter into the world of man, i.e., the only world in which the meaning of its suffering would be understandable. Then I pushed forward with the following question. And what about man? Are you sure that the human world is a terminal point in the evolution of the cosmos? Is it not conceivable that there is still another dimension? A world beyond man's world? A world in which the question of an ultimate meaning of human suffering would find an answer? Frankl, 1984a. I just referred to another dimension, at the same time indicating that it would not be accessible to reason or intellect. By the same token, it necessarily would elude any strict scientific approach. Small wonder that ultimate meaning is missing in the world as described by science. However, does this imply that the world is void of ultimate meaning? I think it only shows that science is blind to ultimate meaning. Ultimate meaning is scotomized by science. However, this state of affairs does in no way entitle a scientist to deny that ultimate meaning possibly does exist. It is perfectly legitimate that the scientist as such restricts himself to a certain cross-section he cuts through reality, and it may well happen that within this cross-section no meaning whatsoever can be found. But he should remain aware that also other cross-sections are conceivable. Consider a horizontal plane wherein 5 points are located. Isolated points, disconnected points, points without a meaningful connection between them. Well, these points should serve as symbols for events that, at least at first sight, seem to be pure chance, only chance, to apply the words used by Jacques Monod in his book Chance and Necessity, when he spoke of those mutations which account for no more or less than evolution. He conceived of them as random events, that is to say, events with no meaning behind them. But what about having a vertical plane orthogonally intersect the horizontal one in such a way that the 5 points prove to be the spots on which a curve lying on the vertical plane intersects the horizontal one? Suddenly, we become aware that there does exist a connection between the 5 points, although it hides in a different dimension. Well, isn't it possible that there also exists a meaningful connection between what, at first sight, seems to be no more than random events, such as the mutations? Once we no longer keep our view restricted to the biological plane, but widen our horizon by including in our view the next higher dimension, we immediately recognize that here too a higher or deeper meaning may well exist, although it does not show up in the lower dimension. exactly as the higher or lower portions of the curve were not discernible on the horizontal plane. The fact remains that not everything can be explained in meaningful terms. But what now can be explained is at least the reason why this is necessarily impossible. At least it is impossible on merely intellectual grounds. An irrational rest is left. But what is unknowable need not be unbelievable. In fact, where knowledge gives up, the torch is passed on to faith. True, it is not possible to find out intellectually whether everything is ultimately meaningless or whether there is ultimate meaning behind everything. But if we cannot answer the question intellectually, we may well do so existentially. Where an intellectual cognition fails, an existential decision is due. Vis-à-vis the fact that it is equally conceivable that everything is absolutely meaningful and that everything is absolutely meaningless, in other words, that the scales are equally high, we must throw the weight of our own being into one of the scales. And precisely therein I see the function to carry out my belief. In contrast to what people are prone to assume, namely, believing is not at all some sort of thinking minus the reality of that which is thought. Believing is rather some sort of thinking plus something, namely, the existentiality of him or her who does the thinking. And how does the man or the woman in the street actually proceed in the face of the unknowable? Or let me, in order to answer this question, ask you another one. Did you ever stand on a stage? If so, you may remember that, blinded by footlights and spotlights, you saw in front of yourself just a black hole, rather than anything such as an audience. But you still remained believing in the existence and presence of the audience, didn't you? Well, the same holds for a portion of the human population on our planet, however large or small the portion may be. They, too, remain believing. Blinded by the trivialities of everyday life, they fill the black hole with symbols. Like the actor or the actress who cannot see the audience before which they play their roles, likewise human beings desire to read into, to project into, to see into the nothing confronting them, a something, or better to say, a someone. To put it in a joking vein, they espouse that nuclear tenet of existentialism which I would like to epitomize as follows. Nothingness is really nothingness. That is to say, an ultimate being, paralleling the ultimate meaning, or to speak in plain words, God, is not one thing among others, but being itself, or being, capitalized by Martin Heidegger. From this it follows that you cannot simply place the ultimate being on the same plane as things unless you wish to succumb to the same fallacy as a little boy once did, when he told my wife that he knew what he was going to be when he grew up. She asked what it would be, and he answered, "Either I'll be an acrobat on a trapeze in a circus, or I'll be God." He dealt with God as if being God were one vocation among other vocations. Frankl, 1984b. Particularly in context with the ultimate being, the gap, nay, the abyss between that which is to symbolize on one hand and on the other hand, that which is to be symbolized becomes painful. But to dismiss or renounce symbolization because a symbol is never identical with that for which it stands is unwarranted. Just consider a painting that shows above a landscape the sky. Any painter who is representative of realism more often than not induces the onlooker to see the sky by putting a couple of clouds thereon. But are not the clouds precisely something that is not identical with the sky? Isn't it true that they rather hide it, preventing us from seeing it? Still, the clouds serve as the best and simplest symbol for the sky, don't they? By and large, the divine too is symbolized by what it is not. Its attributes are human properties, not to say all too human ones. God is portrayed in a more or less anthropomorphic way and manner. And yet we are not justified in discarding religion solely on account of all its anthropomorphic ingredients, asymptotically approaching the enigma of ultimate truth on the symbolic rather than on an abstract level, may eventually yield a more productive result. Believe it or not, it was Conrad Lorenz, 1981, who improvisingly said, in a recent conversation with Franz Kreutzer, "If you compare the validity of the worldview, Weltanschauung, of an alpine farmer's wife with the validity of B.F. Skinner's worldview, you discover that the farmer's wife who believes in the Immaculate Conception of the Holy Mary, in the dear Lord, and in all the saints, still has come closer to truth than the behaviorist. On the other hand, there are undeniable pitfalls in store for us whenever we embark on anthropomorphism uncritically. An instance that illustrates the point is the following joke. A Sunday school teacher once told her class a story of a poor man whose wife had died in childbirth. He could not afford to hire a wet nurse, but God worked a miracle by letting breasts grow on the chest of the poor man so that the newborn baby could be suckled. One of the boys, however, objected that there was no need to work a miracle. Why did not God simply arrange for the poor man to find an envelope with $1,000 to pay a wet nurse? But the teacher replied, "You are a silly boy. If God can work a miracle, he certainly will not throw away cash." Why do we laugh? Because a certain human category, namely saving cash, has been applied to the motivations of God. Frankel, 1984b. After discussing the need for symbols, we may define religion as a system of symbols, i.e. symbols for that which humans cannot grasp in conceptual terms. But isn't the need for symbols, the capacity to create them and to use them, a fundamental characteristic of being human at large? Isn't the capacity to speak and to understand speech acknowledged as a distinctive feature of humanness? Well, it is also legitimate to define the individual languages developed by mankind as systems of symbols. But comparing religion with language, one should also keep in mind that nobody is justified in claiming that the particular language spoken by himself is superior to another one. After all, it is possible in any language to arrive at truth, at the one truth, and it is also possible in any language to err and to lie. However, we are not confronted with linguistic pluralism, but also with religious pluralism, the latter being represented by the fact that, by and large, religion is split up in various denominations. And again, one denomination cannot claim superiority over against another. But isn't it conceivable that, sooner or later, religious pluralism will be overcome and replaced by religious universalism? I do not think so. I do not deem it probable that some sort of a religious Esperanto could ever serve as a substitute for the individual denominations. What is looming is not a universal religion, but rather the contrary. If religion is to survive, it will have to become a profoundly personalized religion, which allows any human being to speak a language of his or her own when addressing himself or herself to the ultimate being. Gordon W. Allport, in his renowned book, The Individual and His Religion, refers to profoundly personalized religion when he speaks of the Hindu religion. Allport, 1956. Is this to imply that the individual denominations, or for that matter the respective organizations and institutions, will fade away? Not necessarily, for however different the personal styles may be in which human beings express their search for an ultimate meaning and/or address themselves to an ultimate being, there are and always will be symbols that are common to communities. Or aren't there languages that, despite their differences, have the same alphabet in common? I admit that the concept of religion in its widest possible sense, as it is here propounded, goes far beyond the narrow concepts of God that are promulgated by some representatives of denominational religion. They often depict, not to say denigrate, God as a being who is primarily concerned with being believed in by the greatest possible number of believers and along the lines of a specific creed at that. Just believe, we are told, and everything will be okay. But alas, not only is this order based on a distortion of any sound concept of deity, but even more important, it is doomed to failure. Obviously, there are certain activities that simply cannot be commanded, demanded, or ordered. You cannot order anyone to laugh. If you want him to laugh, you must tell him a joke. And if you want people to have faith and belief in God, you cannot rely on preaching along the lines of a particular church, but must in the first place portray your God believably, and you must act credibly yourself. In other words, you have to do the very opposite of what so often is done by the representatives of organized religion when they build up an image of God as someone who is primarily interested in being believed in, and who rigorously insists that those who believe in him be affiliated with a particular church, Small wonder that such representatives of religion behave as though they saw the main task of their own denomination as that of overriding other denominations. Before, we spoke of addressing oneself to deity in an utmost personal mode of expression. Usually, such a mode of speaking to God is called praying. Truly, prayer is a person-to-person call. Indeed, it could be considered the climax of the I-thou relationship that Martin Buber regarded as the most characteristic quality of human existence, that is, its dialogical quality. However, I think that there are not only interpersonal but also intrapersonal dialogues, inner dialogues, dialogues within ourselves. In other words, dialogues need not take place between an ego and a two, but may take place between an ego and an alter ego as well. And it is in this context that I would like to offer you a peculiar definition of God at which, I confess, I arrived at the age of 15 years. In a sense, it is an operational definition. It reads as follows. God is the partner of our most intimate soliloquies. That is to say, whenever you are talking to yourself in utmost sincerity and ultimate solitude, he to whom you are addressing yourself may justifiably be called God. As you notice, such a definition circumvents the bifurcation between atheistic and theistic Weltanschauung. The difference between them emerges only later on, when the irreligious person insists that his soliloquies are just that, monologues with himself, and the religious person interprets his as real dialogues with someone other than himself. Well, I think that what here should count first and more than anything else is the utmost sincerity and honesty. And I am sure that if God really exists, he certainly is not going to argue with the irreligious persons because they mistake him for their own selves and therefore misname him. The question still remains whether irreligious persons really exist. In a book of mine, The Unconscious God, I assemble and evaluate some indications to the effect that a religious sense is existent and present in each and every person, albeit buried, not to say repressed, in the unconscious. Frankel, 1985a. In other words, when Freud once contended that man is not only often much more immoral than he believes, but also often much more moral than he thinks, we may say that he is often much more religious than he admits. This omnipresence of religion, to be sure, religion in its widest possible sense, its ubiquity in the unconscious, may well account for the fact, already discussed, that, as empirically evidenced by tests and statistics, people who regard themselves as irreligious are no less capable of finding meaning in their lives than those who consider themselves to be religious. Small wonder that such an inherent, though inexplicit, religiousness proves to be more persistent and resistant than we may expect it to be, inasmuch as it defies outer as well as inner circumstances to an incredible degree. Once, for example, I had the doctors of my hospital department screen an unselected group of patients regarding the correlation of their father image with their religious development. It turned out that a poor religious life cannot simply be traced back to the impact of a negative father image. Nor does even the worst father image necessarily prevent one from establishing a sound religious Weltanschauung. Frankel, 1985b. So much regarding the impact of education. How about the environment's influence? Suffice it to point out that, as far as both my professional experience, Frankel 1985c, and my personal experiences, Frankel 1986, offer evidence, religion did not even die in Auschwitz, nor after Auschwitz, to allude to the title of a book that was authored by a rabbi, who incidentally had not been there. I personally think that either belief in God is unconditional, or it is not belief at all. If it is unconditional, it will stand and face the fact that 6 million died in the Nazi Holocaust. If it is not unconditional, it will fall away if only a single innocent child has to die, to resort to an argument once advanced by Dostoevsky. The truth is that among those who actually went through the experience of Auschwitz, the number of those whose religious life was deepened, in spite, not to say because of this experience, by far exceeds the number of those who gave up their belief. To paraphrase what La Rochefoucauld once remarked with regard to the effect that separation has on love, One might say that just as the small fire is extinguished by the storm while a large fire is enhanced by it, likewise a weak faith is weakened by predicaments and catastrophes, whereas a strong faith is strengthened by them. So much for the outer circumstances. And what about the inner ones? For instance, psychoses. In a book of mine, The Will to Meaning, I describe the case of a severe manic phase, Frankl, 1984b. In other books of mine, a patient suffering from an endogenous depression, Frankl, 1985a, and other patients suffering from schizophrenia, Frankl, 1984a and b. All of them showed an indestructible and indelible sense of religiousness. Ladies and gentlemen, after propounding an operational definition of religion as impartial and neutral as mine, encompassing even agnosticism and atheism, I hope to be justified in contending, one, that I was entitled indeed to deal with religion as a psychiatrist, and two, that I also remained a psychiatrist throughout my presentation by treating religion as a human phenomenon, more specifically, as an outgrowth of what I regard to be the most human of all human phenomena, namely the will to meaning. Religion, we may say, revealed itself as the fulfillment of what we now may call the will to ultimate meaning. Incidentally, my definition of religion is paralleled by another one which was presented by Albert Einstein, 1950, and reads as follows. To be religious is to have found an answer to the question, what is the meaning of life? And there is still another definition which was offered by Ludwig Wittgenstein, 1960, and reads as follows. To believe in God is to see that life has a meaning. As you see, Einstein, the physicist, and Wittgenstein, the philosopher, as well as I myself as a psychiatrist, arrived at definitions of religion that are overlapping each other. To be sure, there is a question to be left open, or better to say, to be answered by the theologian, namely, the question, to which extent are the three definitions of religion acceptable to him? The only thing we psychiatrists can do is to keep the dialogue between religion and psychiatry going on in the spirit of that mutual tolerance which is indispensable in the era of pluralism and in the area of medicine, but also in the spirit of that mutual tolerance which imbues the memorable exchange of letters between Oscar Pfister and Sigmund Freud. Thank you for your attention.
This has been a Gildan Audio production. For more affordable, life-changing audio programs, visit our website at gildanmedia.com.